Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show from America, where Bush-led self-inflicted terrorism, fascism, are practiced daily. Soon our troops will learn a new dance called the goose-stepping. And if you don't like the picture, you can be a guest in one of our new 600 prisons with room service provided by the U.S. Army. Welcome, 1340 AM Tan Talk radio listeners, making me the voice of Tampa Bay. And welcome all of the BBS listeners all over the world in 104 countries that we're in. Our guest today, October 19th, 2007, is David Icke, a fellow pioneer, a leader in consciousness movements and waking up the masses. Hi, David. How are you doing?
Very good, Fred. Thank you.
Oh, it's good to hear from you and good to talk to you on my favorite island in the whole world, the Isle of Wight.
I couldn't believe you used to live there.
Yeah. Yeah, we
it's
were
only 35 miles by 15. Most people miss it, you know.
Yeah, and I found out, you know, checking you out, I found out you and I have a real similar problem, and that is we like trains. My grandfather's from Newbury. He was English, and I started riding trains and building semaphores, and I even had a whole collection of live steam trains over here in America. I used to ride them all the time.
My sons are into steam trains as well. I brought them up good.
Yeah, you've got some beautiful ones. I know, being a member of the Live Steam Club over here in America, we've had guys come from London and in England bringing some beautiful inch-and-a-half scale engines over here to run on our tracks, you know.
I was born in a place called Leicester in the English Midlands, and it was quite a railway city, so I was brought up with, steam trains in the 50s and the 60s, and So I caught the bug then, really. But, they've got life, they've got energy, they've got a life force, whereas the ones that replace them are just boxes on wheels, really.
Yeah, one time my grandfather had me in an old steam engine, I don't know where, it was back in the East Coast, and I got to get up in the cab and watch the guy shovel coal into the boiler. This is back in the 50s. And that was an experience. Like, that was a live, living experience, watching the fireman shovel the coal in the boiler on an old passenger train. It was phenomenal. And then, of course, the other side of the coin is I remember not too long ago riding a bullet train in Japan, in Tokyo, sitting in the bar car having a glass of wine. The wine's not even moving, and the speedometer on the wall says 150 miles an hour.
I know. I've been on that. I mean, that's just extraordinary. I mean, the countryside's passing like a bullet, and nothing in the train's moving. Incredible.
I like the old clunky ones better, though, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, because England, Britain in general, particularly England, has got preserved steam lines all over the place, and it's like going back to the 50s and the 60s when you go there, and some of them are like 20 miles long. And I've been to the one the Grand Canyon, from Williams to the Grand Canyon, and one or two others, but not too many American steam engines seem to have made it, really, compared with here.
No. My biggest thrill was getting to get up in the cabin of Al Broadfoot, runs that one over in Canada, it's a great big Hudson, it's a Royal Hudson. I got to play with that one day, you know, and that was kind of neat. And I got pictures of me with the steam going off all over the place, and that was my biggest thrill, I think, in recent times. But anyway, getting into our topics today, there's so much we can talk about because we both believe in the same things. I like the way your take on as is more like on the Matrix, and mine has been an old physicist has been more on the hologram and leading into quantum mechanics. But the message is the same, and I want to cover, first of all, I'm a different audience. I know you've been on this network before, but I have a different audience. And I was watching a video of you, and you were going to South America when you first started out, and you first got crazy like we all are now, and before you became, laughed at and all of that. What was your first experience like on some mountain somewhere? I'd like to go into that for a second.
Yeah, first of all, I'm really into the holographic nature of reality. I think that's what this apparently physical world is. So we're at one on that. I had some amazing experiences which put me on the path, if you like. I was a professional soccer player, and then I got arthritis, and I left to become a journalist, and then I became a television presenter and also a national spokesman for the British Green Party, which allowed me to see politics from the inside and showed me clearly that politics is anything but the answer. It's massively part of the problem and an expression of the problem. And then towards the end of the 1980s, about 1989, I'm still working for the BBC, I started having these this very strong feeling that when I was in a room on my own, I wasn't alone. And this built up and built up and built up until one day I'm sitting in a hotel where I'm working for the BBC, and I'm in this room on my own, and I remember sitting there and saying, look, if there's something there, would you please contact me, because you're driving me up the wall. And a series of things happened, and I went to see a psychic lady, and she started talking about this presence and all the rest of it that had been around me, which I hadn't discussed with her at all. And it kind of went on and on and on. And eventually I ended up having this overwhelming feeling to go to Peru. This is in early 91 now. And I went there purely on this urge. And I had some amazing experiences. And it culminated with I was in a place called Puno in southern Peru, not far from Lake Titicaca. And I had this Peruvian guy, a guide, who was showing me around the place for about 3 weeks. And it wasn't a normal tourist thing, because we were going off into some very strange things. Anyway, he booked us in this hotel called the Siyustani, which is a Inca ruin site about an hour and a half's drive from Puno. And there's pictures of this thing at this place all over the hotel, obviously. And every time I looked at the picture, I thought, I've got to go there, I've got to go there, I've got to go there. And I went in this tourist bus, which I had to hire, just me and the guide and the driver, because it was out of season. And we ended up at this place. It was beautiful in the middle of nowhere, mountains and in the distance on every side, and a lagoon, and then this big hill with all the Inca ruins on the top. And the only people there were a couple of children with a llama for tourist photographs, but there were no tourists. Anyway, I had this real strong urge to go there, and I walked around for about an hour, and it was very nice. But when I went back to the bus, I was disappointed, because what I'd experienced did not match the urge I had to go there. Anyway, I get in the bus, and we're just going about 3 minutes down the road, and I'm daydreaming out the window, and I saw this mound to my right. And when I looked at this mound, all I could hear in my head was, come to me, come to me, come to me, come to me. And I said, could you stop the bus a minute? I want to go up that mound, because I'm still just out of television. I don't know what's happening to my life, what's happening. And so I got up, and I went up the mound. And when I got to the top, I couldn't see it from the road, where there was a circle of standing stones about waist high, like a mini Stonehenge. And I walked into the middle. And this had happened to me once before, but we're at the start of all this, but never as powerful as this. I walked into the middle of the circle, and it was like two gigantic magnets were pulling my feet to the ground. And it was, my feet started to burn. And then I felt this, what I now realize was energy going into the top of my head, straight through my body and through my feet, and then another flow coming the other way. And then I heard this voice in my head, like a very strong thought form, it's all about voices, which said, first of all, they'll be talking about this 100 years from now, and I'm thinking, talking about what? And then the next one was, it will be over when you fear the rain. And I'm standing there under a cloudless Peruvian sky with a red-hot sun, big red nose to prove it, and I'm hearing this, it will be over when you feel the rain, just insane. And then my arms went out at 45 degrees. Of course, if you do that, after about 30 seconds, your arms begin to ache. But mine were there for, I don't know, 45 minutes to an hour. Time just disappeared in the period of what happened. And this energy coming through me got stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. And I kept going in and out of consciousness, like when you drive a car and you forget where the last few miles have gone. And then I noticed in one of these, back to consciousness periods, But over the distant mountains, there was this light grey mist, and over the period as it went on, and the energy was getting stronger and stronger. My body's shaking now, like I'm plugged into some energy source. And as this went on, the light grey mist became a dark grey mist, and then it was clear it was pouring with rain over the distant mountains. And then this storm came out of the mountains, and it was literally a straight line. You know, we talk about weather fronts. Well, this one was a weather front like someone had drawn it with a ruler. And it was coming towards me. And it got to, as it got closer, I could see the rain. It was pouring down, absolutely torrential. And it was coming towards me like curtains going across the land. And by this time, I'm holding on to this energy, which is, the whole body's kind of shaking. And then it was above me, the sun had been covered in, and then the rain hit me. And when the rain hit me, it was like someone had switched the switch off. And I staggered forward, I could hardly stand. My shoulders, which had had my arms out all that time, were now agony as well, although I hadn't felt it before. And I looked across and I saw the Peruvian guide, who I didn't even realize had come up from the bus, looking at me, understandably, with a very strange look on his face. And from that time, my life just changed. I came back and, my job was taken away at the BBC out of nowhere, or had been taken away out of nowhere before, but my job as a presenter, was over. I wasn't going down that route anymore in television or journalism. I wasn't going to be a journalist in the, you know, traditional sense. And everything in my life fell apart and, a new life started to appear. So it was a very pivotal time in my life, and exactly what went on, I still don't know, but it was life-changing, whatever it was.
Yeah, you know, I was a little bit before you with that experience here in Laguna Beach in 1971, after I'd worked for NASA and been all over the government lines and in and out of secret bases. I'd walked away from it because I saw what a joke it all was and where it was going, and I had a similar experience. And later on, I found out, for me, it was becoming a contactee. And, of course, everybody laughed at me like they did you when you made your first big presentations, but they don't laugh anymore because they can see the fascist way this world is heading in the Orwellian,
exactly,
you know, model. It's so perfect. I mean, you could almost see, as Bush comes through, Hitler going through as the Reich Chancellor, you know, the homeland, the fatherland, you know, the Gestapo, the secret police here. I mean, and in America and in your country, I mean, it's a perfect model. It's a reflection of a coin with two sides and just a different language, and it all became apparent. But back in 1971, I wouldn't have thought that. I had no idea. I just knew there was something wrong, but I didn't know what it was. So anyway, as we go now, what's it like over there? I mean, over here, we're already getting our money driven into the ground. The pound is 2-1 against the American dollar, as you well know. You guys can come over here and buy our country if you want.
it's so blatant when you look at different countries, apparently unconnected with, quote, individual governments, that the same things are being introduced, often the legislation even has the same wording. I got a friend in New Zealand who was telling me how they passed anti-terrorist legislation. What? In New Zealand? Yeah, New Zealand.
Yeah,
and,
New Zealand. So that's once again a martial law.
They've started to use this terrorist legislation.
Right.
It's just for terrorists, by the way, against their own people, like environmental activists and stuff. And that's
right.
Precisely what has happened in Britain and what is happening in America. When people just take a step back and they look at what's unfolding, it is a bigger conspiracy theory or non-conspiracy theory to believe that all these different things are being introduced in all these different countries in the same way, being used in the same way, and it's all by accident somehow and not by centrally coordinated design. But the thing is, the whole system is designed, and to a significant effect, what's happening in terms of economics is a massive contribution to this. It's designed to keep people in a state of daily survival. because when you're in a state of daily survival, your whole focus in life is on surviving. That may be a truism and obvious, but often we forget the obvious. And while you're constantly in a state of surviving and trying to survive and worrying about not surviving, you're not lifting your head and seeing what's actually going on. You're in too much of a desperate state of trying to last another week or another month. And so the whole system is designed to keep people's heads down. I think there was a quote in that document, Silent Weapons for a Quiet War, that came to light, which talks about keep them busy, busy, busy back on the farm with the other animals. And if you can get people in a state of economic anxiety, then they're going to be talking about, look, mate, don't talk to me about all that stuff. I live in the real world. I've got to survive another month. And it's important that we don't fall for that, because if we do, we're falling right into the trap of not lifting our heads and not looking at what is going on, and therefore not being able to remove the cause of the economic problems, which is by a calculated design to bring about the outcome that they want, which is human control.
Yeah, they're doing a brilliant job of it. They did it in 1903. They did it in 1929. Now they're doing it now with the banks and mortgages and land over here. And, you know, we have the highest rate of foreclosures, once again, in America that we've had, you know, in years. And they're devaluating the dollar. They're just forcing people to their knees as fast as they can over here. I don't know what the economic state of land and mortgages is in your country, but it's definitely on the downturn here.
In this country, the whole economic system's like this, but it's very much like this in Britain at the moment. You ever see these cartoons when there's a load of cartoon characters chasing someone, and eventually the one they're chasing in his panic runs over the edge of a cliff, and they all chase him over the edge of the cliff, and they all keep running forward on fresh air, just as they were on the land, until someone looks down and realizes the land is gone, and then they all crash down into the valley. And that's what the economic system is like, and certainly what the British economy is like at the moment. It is absolutely being held together by mountains and mountains of debt, personal debt, business debt, government debt. And it is running on fresh air, but because, they still hand the cards over and they still buy something, there is this... This false idea that all is well, when any time it could crash, because there's nothing holding it together except confidence. And that's the thing, you know, that the way that they manipulate at will the world economic system is simply by manipulating confidence or lack of confidence. And they do this by the information they put out about the state of the economy. And Greenspan, as was, and indeed still is being used to do the same thing, Alan Greenspan, he says something positive about the economy, everything goes up. He says something negative about the economy, everything goes down. It's just built on confidence. And I remember years ago, I spoke at this economic conference about the way this manipulation went on. And afterwards, some guy who makes his money out of, the casino of futures markets and all this stuff, commodities, he came over to me and said, well, that's a bit far-fetched to me, mate. He says, but I'll keep an eye on things and I'll see if I see anything. And I met him again about 3 or 4 months later, and what he noticed was that a few days before Alan Greenspan made an economic statement, the big players in the market would get into things and they would get out of things on block. And every time Greenspan's statement a few days later had the effect of pushing up what they got into and pushing down what they got out of. And the reason is they were writing Greenspan's statement. This is what people have to understand if they're going to see what's going on. They need to start bringing down these ideas of barriers between positions, these barriers between political parties, these barriers between countries. Actually, we're looking at one-party states that masquerade as multi-party states. And it's all orchestrated to bring about the end of human control. And the bottom line of that is the control of humanity's sense of reality. We can talk about how they do that on a massive scale by manipulating the way we actually create reality. But even on that more mundane or basic scale of the world economy, if you like, it's about manipulating our sense of reality. We are confident we will buy things. The economy will have energy. We're not confident we will not buy things. The economy will not have energy. It's as simple as that. It's just a mind game.
Yeah, it's amazing, you know, with all of that manipulation going on, how the British pound sterling is probably the strongest currency in the world right now.
Yeah, but they can bring that down very quickly by changing. The reason that the pound is strong at the moment is people have a perception of confidence in the pound sterling. As soon as that confidence is undermined, and it can be done very quickly by information, false or otherwise, and down it goes. It's that simple. And people say, well, why would people who have vast amounts of money in the stock markets, etc., and currencies, why would they want to bring the currency down, or why would they want to bring the stock market down? Well, even on a financial level, a basic financial level, never mind a bigger picture of global control. If you know that something's going to crash because you're going to crash it, then you just get out of that, let it crash, and then buy back in the market at a few cents on the dollar. And suddenly you change the confidence, you push back up what you pushed down, and now you have vastly more control and power because of all the assets you brought up on a few cents on the dollar after you crashed it. Of course, the famous story that many people will know is the way that during the Battle of Waterloo, the Rothschilds in the city of London put out false information that Britain had lost the Battle of Waterloo, and there was a massive crash in the stock market. Covertly, Rothschild agents were in place to buy up all this stock, which had crashed to next to nothing, and then the news came through that actually Britain had won the Battle of Waterloo and the stock market recovered, and the Rothschilds were incredibly more wealthy and powerful than they were at the start of the day. Now, that's just one example from history of what's going on every day all over the world. And they're playing with people's lives because those lives do not matter to these people. They do
not have the ability to
empathize with the victims of their actions. Therefore, anything goes.
Yeah, I agree. So, David, what do you think about the gold prices? Do you think they'll? I think that they'll, before they get to 1,000, they'll drop in the spring because they typically go up in the wintertime, and then that would be a better time to invest in gold. I know some people are probably going that direction.
Yeah.
What do you feel about that?
I don't have a lot of money, so I don't have any to invest really. Investments and stuff like that are not something that occupy my mind at all. But the thing is that when you realize that the control of all these things is in the hands of a small cabal of interbreeding families, then the gold price will go up when they choose it to go up, and it will go down when they choose it to go down.
Yeah.
I mean, until very recently, and still in truth, the gold price was set every morning in London at the offices of N.M. Rothschild. Wherever you look, the same families keep coming up in terms of control of all this. And it's nothing to do with people's lives. It's everything to do with controlling people's lives. And until this cabal is removed and true freedom and true control over our destiny is put back in the hands of people, this Orwellian state is going to go on being imposed by the day, as it is now. I mean, you know, in Britain, from the point of view of control and the Orwellian state, I mean, we've made enormous strides in that direction since 9/11, through the Blair years and now into Gordon Brown. We have a record number of cameras in Britain per head of population. It's reckoned that if you walk through the average British city or town and you go about your normal business for a day, you're going to be picked up and filmed by at least 300 cameras. That's what it's like here now.
Yeah, and you know what? It's getting like that over here. Just about every street now has radar control for the speed. You know, it's amazing. In the little town of Laguna Beach where I live in, we've got lots of cameras and lots of radar control now everywhere. It's just amazing. Another area I wanted to go into.
It's not something that's random. It's not something that's being created by a series of independent decisions all over the world that are making this happen. It's centrally coordinated, and we're just seeing the tip at the moment unfolding, because this goes into microchipping, it goes into satellite connection to the microchip, satellite surveillance, and all the rest of it on a scale that people don't even begin to understand the scale of what's being created, so that we have constant surveillance and constant control, not least of those people who are questioning and exposing what's going on. And we have a window of time now where the cell door is creaking towards slamming shut, where we still have enough ability to communicate this information to make a difference. But the idea is to keep the people so occupied and so diverted with irrelevancies that by the time the control, the surveillance, the imposition is blatantly obvious, by then the door has clicked shut, because the technological surveillance, etc., is in place to snuff out what you might call resistance or challenge to this Orwellian global state. And so what we're seeing now is constant efforts to keep us looking the other way, to keep us concentrating on other things, and all around us, while we're focused on the light, like a moth on the porch, the Orwellian state's being constructed around us. And by the time most people realize, hey, what the heck is this, the door will have clicked shut. That's why, you know, we're trying to get this information out, all of us, to bring forward the time when the penny drops of what's actually going on.
Yeah. When, one of the big things that I've seen for mind control over here is putting very bad things in the food that causes depression, and then big pharma engineering mind control drugs with homicidal ideation and dispensing them to our entire populace. Now, I'm assuming that's happening over in England, too.
Yes, it is, and this is a very, very important point. I've got a book that's just coming out of the printers now called The David Icke Guide to the Global Conspiracy and How to End It, in which I just pulled together all, I think, the most relevant information over 28 chapters of the massive work. And one theme of it and a number of chapters are actually connected to exactly what you're talking about there, Fred. It is, as you know, and anyone who researches this for long enough knows, it's not just the individual dots of manipulation that really show the picture. It's when those dots are connected. And then you can see why society is as it is. I always see the human body like a biological computer. It's a vehicle for consciousness to express itself in this reality. And if you are sitting at the keyboard symbolically and you're trying to get through the computer what you're trying to say, what you're trying to communicate, what you're trying to understand, while your computer is subject to various viruses or other problems, then you're not going to do it as well. You're not going to, your vehicle for your message, your communication, is not going to be as effective as if that computer is in pristine condition. And it's the same with the human body, and you're absolutely right. This is a key area for people to understand. They're not putting additives in food, chemical additives in food and drink and all this electromagnetic pollution and all the stuff that we are subject to all the time. But this is not by accident. This is by design. And one of the major reasons for it, in terms of food additives and drink additives, the prime reason for it is to destabilize the ability of the human body, the brain, whatever you want to, all areas, to work efficiently and be a efficient, sharp vehicle for consciousness to express itself in this reality. And when I look at children, and, you know, I go sometimes to, you know, children's events with my family, and I see these bottles of drink. Drinks as near as I could get to it. I wouldn't really call it that even. And you look at the ingredients, and it's a chemical cocktail. Now, the body is an electrochemical phenomena on one level. And so the more that you can feed these chemicals into a chemical system, and electromagnetic and microwave energies into an electrical system, you are going to destabilize that system's ability to operate in a balanced and efficient way. And that's what all this is about, to destabilize us and stop us reaching our full potential for turning consciousness into conscious awareness of what's going on.
Yeah, I agree. And one of the areas that I really got into when I was first taken into the military, I was only 16 years old, so they put me down at Little Rock, Arkansas, and they billeted me, and that happened to be, and I was only 16, and that happened to be where they were working with biochemical warfare, and there was a large homosexual community of scientists running this, and one of the drugs I noticed that they were using down there of mind control was called phencyclidine, and when it came out on the streets, I think it was an experiment to bring it out on the streets as an animal tranquilizer, they called it angel dust, the love drug. But effectively, right. I knew for a fact that this was one of the earlier mind control drugs that even the KGB had experimented with. Today, I see that there's two components. One is called cyclohexane, one is called cyclohexene, and a third component, papiridine. I see all that in our inoculation drugs for against viruses. I see it in Effexor. I see it in all these drugs they're prescribing. I see the key ingredients of angel dust. And furthermore, it's my feeling, and this is probably getting into more your area too, that that we have transmitters, possibly in the Clementine satellites, above the Earth in rotation that produce what I call the reptilian energies, that when a certain amount of this drug is ingested into the human brain, it produces a psychohypnotic trance state in waking consciousness and causes violence. And when this violence is enacted, it causes us to create laws against gun control and all these other kinds, guns, ownership, and therefore suddenly, we have these legislations taking away more of our constitutional freedoms, at least in this country. That's been sort of one of my observations. What's your take on that?
I agree with you. I think that we haven't understood the level to which human behavior is being manipulated at this time technologically. And more obviously through food and drink additives. When you look at, and vaccines come to that, when you look at the graph of when these additives started to become part of everyday food consumption, and you look at the graphs of childhood behavior, the two are almost magnetically connected. So it's like we get so caught by looking at the twigs, we don't see the forest. And if you take a step back and look at it from a wider perspective, you have young children. Their brains and their bodies are still developing. They are electrochemical beings at the level of the body, and every day they are consuming increasingly vast amounts of chemicals into the body, which are rewiring the brain. They're rewiring the chemical balance of the body. And as a result, they are having a massively negative effect on behavior. And what concerns me, Fred, is that it's cumulative. you know, a lot of these chemicals, they're not just ingested and then removed. The body holds on to them, and they become cumulative. And what we are building in terms of the adults of the future, given the amount of this stuff that people have ingested from a young age over the last 2-3 decades or so, they're thinking about, because you can be a sharp consciously in terms of consciousness as you like, but symbolically, you know, you can be a brilliantly sharp computer operator sitting at the desk. But if your computer's not working right, you cannot transfer that brilliance as a computer operator through the computer, because it will not respond to what you're trying to make it do, because it's not working properly. And the body's like that, and the brain's like that, in relation to the consciousness that's trying to work through it. And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to destabilize the vehicle so that we cannot manifest the true magnitude of who we are, and we operate in this bewildered, bemused, chemically imbalanced, electrically imbalanced state, which breeds fear, it breeds violence, and as you quite rightly say, having created the problem, they can then offer the solution, which is more and more control.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. I do a lot of work.
Then you've got, well, hold on a second.
Yeah.
Who are all these corporations who are putting all these additives in food? Who are all these corporations that are controlling the banking system, which is fresh air money, based on confidence, which they control by putting out positive or negative information about the state of the economy? And you go around all these different, who are these pharmaceutical corporations who are putting out these drugs that destabilize and chemically imbalance the body? Who are these people that are putting out the vaccines that are bombarding grotesquely young bodies and young immune systems and devastating them for life? Is this all happening by accident? All these corporations with different names in different places doing the same thing to the same basic end? Of course it's not. It's coordinated. The corporations are merely faces, or masks, a better way of describing it. They're merely masks on the same face. And although they have different names and they're in different countries, they have the same master. And that's why it's possible to coordinate all this stuff on a global level to a common end.
Yeah, I ran into that, you know, when I got my degree in homeopathic medicine. I started formulating back in 1981. And it was real interesting because in Japan, when Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs went off, certain people over there close to the radiation didn't have radiation side effects. And we found out they were on gotacola ginseng and a couple other herbs, Fotai, which created electrolytes in their brain that blew, you know, that retarded radiation. And then I got over to Europe and I tried to formulate over there, and they wouldn't let me use these things. The FDA in Europe, primarily in Germany, said, well, can't use this stuff. This is a drug. So then I learned about B complex and nitrilicides, B12 through 17, which is anti-cancer. I tried to formulate in Japan and we could use the Fotai ginseng and gotacola, but we couldn't use the B complex over there. It was against the law. And then I went up to Canada because we need the proteins to restabilize the effects of drugs on the hormonal system in the body. And they kicked me out of Canada because, you know, my protein powder formulas were also considered drugs. So I love the labeling that goes on. It's like you say, it's the same snake, you know.
Yeah, the thing is, Fred, that once you get the basic structure in place, i.e. what the manipulators are trying to achieve and the methods they use to achieve it, then the word starts to become much clearer. Because if you assume, if you're coordinate is that governments are there to try to serve the interests of the people, then what goes on is insane. But when you realize that they're not there to do that, they're there to be vehicles for introducing global control, then it starts to make sense. And people talk about, you know, those that write and talk about conspiracies. Oh, you see conspiracies everywhere. Well, I don't see conspiracies everywhere. I see one conspiracy with many different facets and many different ways of expressing itself. So when you get the coordinate that the idea is to destabilize the human body and mental, emotional and physical levels, therefore it becomes quite clear why anything, no matter how ludicrous, like aspartame, that will achieve that end, gets through the so-called government agencies that's supposed to protect us from this stuff. And then people like you and many others around the world who have found ways of bringing a balance back to the mental, emotional, and physical levels to, in other words, balance out what is happening in terms of the destabilization, they, by the same force that's allowing these destabilizing chemicals onto the market without checks, and even against checks that say don't do it, they're the same forces that are jumping on people like you and others and saying, you can't use that, you can't do this, you can't do the other, because the goal is to destabilize the body. Therefore, anything that will do that is supported. Anything that would stop that happening is jumped upon. This is the same reason why so many people that have had great discoveries in health have ended up in jail, because they are a contribution to undermining the agenda for control. And in all areas of our lives, you can see this, where people come out with great ideas, and the ideas are either ignored or they're jumped upon, and the people targeted because the idea, they're good ideas, yes, but they're not good ideas if you have an agenda of control to introduce. So it all starts to make sense why people trying to do decent things get jumped upon, and people trying to do extremely destructive things are supported by the state. It's because the agenda is to do destructive things.
Yeah, I agree. Now, getting into another topic of symbolism, I know that for a fact you are very much like I am in the area of symbolism, like the Denver Airport in Colorado with the mass underground system that people don't know about, going to all these secret places. So can you talk a little bit about symbolism in the reptilian energies?
Well, in terms of symbolism, I think there's two levels of it. One is like a calling card, but that's the minor level of it. There are, you know, uses of symbolism. It's like a calling card. It's like, you know, to people who know, they understand what the symbol is. But the real, for me, the real key level of symbolism and all the symbolism that we have around us all the time is what it's doing to us subconsciously. What a symbol represents to the creator of the symbol is the energy, vibrational field, frequency, whatever you want to call it, that symbol will vibrate to. I had an example of this when I was in a massive obelisk in the north of England. It was so big out in the countryside that you could walk inside, and there was a spiral staircase going up. And I'm walking up the staircase, and suddenly, not just after I got in, I felt this enormous sense of male sexual energy. And I thought, what the heck is all this about? And then I realized, what am I walking up inside? The phallic symbol, the obelisk, which these guys use to symbolize that. And what something symbolizes is what it generates. And so all around us, these symbols are vibrating energetic frequency fields that represent what those symbols represent. And, you know, if you want to affect all the fish together on a mass scale, what you need to affect is the sea or the lake. And then you affect all of them, because they're all swimming in that water. And we are all living in a massive energy field, a series of energy fields. And if you want to affect all humans in one place, like a city or wherever, then the way to get to all of them is to affect the energy field that we're all in, the energetic sea that we're swimming in, if you like. And so much of the symbolism actually creates energetic fields that are vibrating to certain frequencies, and they're subconsciously affecting us. The subconscious mind is one of its great forms of communication. It is symbols, images, and they use these images to talk to the subconscious all the time. We see it in subliminal advertising and stuff like that. So the symbolism is not just used to, like I say, the calling card, which initiates of that knowledge will understand what it means. They're actually used to affect us in terms of the way we think, our emotions, the way we feel, and the way we behave.
Yeah, it seems like for a long time period going by, you know, in our history, looking back at it, you know, having holy wars to create governments to protect the people while we have more holy wars, and the whole symbolistic approach of government control wars, which we've been talking about through this whole show. I think that on some levels, people like yourself especially are bringing an enlightenment to this world, a waking up, turning on switches. And I think I think we're going to have an effect. I think we are having an effect where I think people, even with all of this mystique, I think we're going to lose a lot of people, probably to cancer and cell phones, because you get brain tumors from cell phones over a period of time, and it's about that period of time, about 12, 15 years. So I think we're going to start losing a lot of people. Depopulation control is just one form of them. But I think that we are going to have a fairly bright group of leaders up and coming in our youth, even though there maybe not be as many of them. I think the ones that are there are going to have proportionately a tremendous control of bringing this all of this horrible stuff we're talking about to an end at some point.
I agree. I mean, we've all been there, but I remember when I started talking about this in the early 90s, very early 90s, and crikey, I mean, you were the nutter, you were the village idiot, you were the crazy man, or you were, you know, someone, what are you looking at him for? And in this period since then, there has been a colossal awakening by vast numbers of people. And it's only now and again when I meet people or I meet groups and people who you wouldn't on the face of it think would be open-minded, and you realize how much they've got it, that it just dawns on you just how deeply into society the pioneers of this knowledge have been, must have felt, it did to me for a long time, banging your head against the wall. What am I doing this for? I don't know, but I just need to be able to keep doing it. It's actually had a massive effect, and I've just been invited to present this information to the Oxford Union, which is a debating society. It goes back to about 1820. All the prime ministers and some of the great world leaders have been there, and they've asked me not to debate, but to present this information. And it's the first time that it's been presented to this Oxford Union, Oxford University, and it's been generated by the interest among the students in the information. It's the same with in areas. I was just involved in a program that's based on the hip hop rap community in London, and I was staggered to realize the extent to which the information we're talking about. And related information has actually embedded itself in that whole community. It's a major area of interest and debate. So there is a tremendous strides being made all the time. And of course, it doesn't seem like that sometimes because the mainstream media never mention it. And of course, if it's not on CBS or the BBC, it doesn't exist to most people. But outside of that mainstream arena, there are enormous numbers of people and gathering numbers who are beginning to see it. Because I talked years ago about the fact that I felt that there was going to be a window of time where what has remained hidden would hit the surface as the Orwellian state was finally put into place. And in that window of time, it would no longer be a case of, hey, this is coming sometime, whenever. It would actually be increasingly in people's faces. And, and we're in that period now. And you know, the people turning to my information in this country, for instance, a lot of it is based on the fact that what they saw me say years ago and they laughed at and dismissed. But now I've always had this saying: you cannot unhear something. Don't be afraid to speak your truth, because if it is in any way true, then it will eventually be shown to be so. So keep speaking your truth. And if people laugh or dismiss you or condemn you, well, so what? They'll do something else tomorrow. Because if what you're saying has any validity, it was shown to be so, and then people will open their minds. And there was a program on British television, a documentary about me earlier this year, called David Icke, Was He Right? ? And that actually came about by the fact that I was talking in Belfast, Ireland in about 94, and was a vast audience. There was about 16 people there, you know, what it was like in those days. That was a good night for me. And one of the people in the audience was a student, and that student became a television producer, and he started to see that what was said that night was happening in the world. And we got an hour television documentary out of it. So it's so important that people keep speaking their truth and don't be frightened of doing so, because you never know where it's going to lead. And these pioneers have already having a tremendous impact, and it's exponential. And the next few years are going to see a real challenge to this control, especially as people have that control put in their face as they are today.
Yeah, I want to tell you, I watched that video this morning, the one you just mentioned, and there was a young David Icke, it reminded me of a young Brett Bell, you know, making these, and the people were laughing at you, but you know, the guy says, they're not laughing with you, they're laughing at you, and in England, I mean, of all the countries, you know, which is definitely a caste system country at some point, you know, with taking the heat, you really took some major heat, that you hung in there. You know, you really
did. At that time, Fred, I couldn't walk down any street in Britain without being laughed at by the people.
Yeah.
I couldn't go into a bar. There was uproar. A comedian only had to say my name on television, then he got laughed. He didn't use a joke. But what it does, as you well know, is if you don't bow to it, if you keep speaking your truth, then eventually, if you've got validity, it will be shown to be true, as I said. But on an individual level, it builds your emotional and mental strength. When you've reached the level of ridicule that I had in this country, which was extraordinary at one point in the early 90s, you either go under, or you let go of the key fear that holds people in servitude, which is the fear of what other people think. Most people are not living their own lives. They're not expressing their own uniqueness. They are living a version of life that they think is acceptable to other people. They are suppressing themselves to stay within the comfort zone. And what happened to me with all the ridicule was that allowed me to let that go, to stop fearing what other people think. And you can't, you know, talk about, you know, non-human reptilian entities and all this stuff, as I subsequently have, if you in any way are concerned about what people think of you, because the very mention of it is bound to attract more ridicule and more, you know, hostility. But as long as you're being true to yourself, that's all that matters. You know if you're being true to yourself. You don't need confirmation from anyone else. You know that. And it's overcoming this fear of what other people think, which keeps so much information out of the public arena. I've had so many people, I'm sure you had too over the years, who come up to you and give you information, but they're terrified of doing it themselves. They want you to be the vehicle for getting it out there.
Oh,
and,
yeah,
very
much.
It's a good job there are some people doing it, because we'd be in real trouble now if people hadn't stood their ground in the past.
When I started with the National Health Federation, which was a freedom-fighting group back in 1974, I also started my company, Paradigm, actually in 75. And one of the things I had done is studied, you know, I worked with some doctors, and we found that if you put a, you know, a gold-plated pyramid on a person taking Valium's head, you know, because we had Valium was a big drug addiction over here with the American housewife in the early, in the mid-70s, that that person would go into the alpha state. So we got some medical information I developed these pyramids, and they were putting them on people's heads. Well, I decided, well, if this is helping people, it's also, it doubles as a dunce cap. So for about the first 12 years of my company, I was never seen in public without a pyramid on my head. No, yeah. I had a lot of experiences with that. I remember one time I was up in the Denver airport, of all places, you know. Some guy ran up and grabbed the pyramid off my head and went running down the halls, tool of the devil, tool of the devil. Just amazing. So I stuck myself out there like you did, but I think in the big picture, we're going to be sleeping a lot better at night, and our children and our families are going to be a lot better off because they had crazy dads. But they, you know, they'll be proud of us one day if they're not now. So I think we are making a difference, and I think we're making a quantum difference now. I think our energies are coming on thousands of times more now than they were just say 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, when you turn things on their head, which is normally the way you get closer to the truth. When you look at it, I say to people, look at the world. Look at what goes on. Look at what's happening. If that world sees me as credible and sane, I'm in trouble.
Exactly.
You know, the world is crazy. If it sees me as crazy, I'm delighted. It's confirmation of my own sanity. This world has to see you as crazy to confirm that you're not. Because the world is insane. It's funny when you turn everything on its head and look back at it, then you can see the truth. But we get so close to it, and we're bombarded with implanted, constantly repeated mantras of what we should believe, and we lose these basic truths. Look at the world. You want to be seen as sane by that? My goodness.
Yeah, exactly. And then, so now we're coming up to 2012, 2013. What? And I know that you made some predictions. They were showing on that video we were mentioning about David Icke, some of your stuff that came true that you'd predicted several years ago. What is your feeling? Maybe not a prediction. What is your feeling is going to happen around the 2013-2012 era, 5 years from now?
Well, I don't see 2012 as a dramatic change in 1 minute, in 1 hour, in 1 year.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I do think it represents a window of tremendous energetic change, which is gathering all the time. I mean, you know, I think that what's happening in the sun at the moment is all connected to this increase in solar activity, and a lot of it is connected to this energetic change. Because when I had that experience in Peru that we talked about, around that same period, just before that, the real start of it, was when I was having that feeling about there was someone in the room, and that there wasn't, so what was it? And it went on and went on. I eventually had this amazing experience, not unlike what happened on the mound with the feet and with the magnetic feet and stuff. And I got led to this book, and it was a psychic lady, and I called her, and I've got arthritis, so that is since I was 15, and I used the excuse, because she did hands-on healing and stuff, I used the excuse of going along for that, but what I really wanted to see is if she picked up anything around me that could give me a fix on what this presence that I kept feeling around me, because I'd never been to a psychic or anything like that before in my life, but I was open to it. And I went along, and she suddenly, after the second or third visit, started getting these pictures of these beings in her mind and passing information on to me, and I was going to go out on the world stage, and I was going to reveal great secrets, and there was a great shadow across the earth that had to be lifted, there was a story that had to be told, all this stuff. And I'm sitting there thinking, you're having a laugh. I present the sport for the BBC. But one of the themes, the reason I tell you that, is one of the themes at that time, both in that, with that psychic, when I was getting all this stuff, all of which has turned out to be true, that side of it, and others that I bumped into at that, around that same time, when I was really starting to consciously awaken to what I didn't know, there was this theme, there is going to be a spiritual revolution in your lifetime, and it's going to be brought about by an energetic change. energies were being released into this reality that were going to break up the control, basically, and people were going to wake up as a result of it. And, you know, you put it on the back burner and you think, oh, well, okay, we'll see what happens. Well, demonstrably, there is a massive wake-up going on in the very period that I was told about at that time. And I'm sure that as we move towards 2012, we're going to see two things happening. The awakening is going to gather and gather and gather and gather. More and more people are going to start waking up to an understanding of the true magnitude of who they are. And people who at the moment, even now as we're speaking, would laugh at this interview, are going to be awake by 2012 and going, why didn't I see it before? Because I've heard so many people say that to me over the years as they've woken up. And on the other side, you've got the desperation of those pathetic people who are so insecure, are so tied to a desperation to survive, are so in fear that they have to control everything, because anything that's in a state of flux is terrifying to someone in a state of survival mode or a state of insecurity. That insecurity cannot stand states of flux where everything flows as it is in the moment. It wants to control everything. It wants to control the result of the football match before the game starts, because then it feels comfortable in its insecurity. And we're going to see that energy manifesting as these interbreeding families and controlling the institutions of state, etc., trying to do as much as they can to stop that awakening. This is what I feel, and I'm seeing it more and more, that this whole thing's about. These people are not even, these people who are aware that this energetic change is taking place, that this cycle has been reached where this change is taking place. All this Orwellian stuff is not even to gather more control, really. It's to try to hold on to the control that they already have. And because of the energetic change, because of the awakening, they're having to try harder and harder and harder to hold on to that control. And it's manifesting as more obvious forms of control, like the technological control and the microchips and all that stuff. For me, the main reason for the microchip, yes, it's about electronic tagging, and yes, it's about, you know, tracking people. But the key thing for me is the microchip is to destabilize electrically and through other means the human body and its ability to be a vehicle for consciousness. It's about stopping this awakening. That's what, for me, the microchip's really about, the bottom line, the real big reason for it.
Yeah, well, with the microchips, I did a whole series. I spent about 10 years on implants, alien implants, studying them. I work with radiology labs out here in California and around the country. And what I found was that, once again, the technology that they used was a holographic projection into the minerals of the body, which is 5% of the body controlling it. And from that, they were actually able to produce an electronic circuit right out of the substance of a person. And I feel that this Magellan's disease that's out there now, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but I imagine you are. Magellan's disease, is kind of a failure where a lot of these chips kind of backfired on them. And I also found out recently that some of the microchip work that they're so proud of is miserably starting to fall apart. I feel that energy follows thought, and that our consciousness and what we're doing is tuning us into a root energy of something greater than ELF and the electromagnetic frequencies. And I think the human psyche, because of our position in the heavens, is now capable of getting into a wavelength and just putting all their stuff and turning it into some form of rabble, you know.
I couldn't agree more, Fred. That is really where I'm at, you know. The thing is that you can be at a level of consciousness where you are aware that certain things harm the body. And when you're at the level of awareness of it, almost like intellectual awareness of it, then it's a good idea to avoid those things, to eat as well as you can and all the rest of it, because you're not yet at the next stage which is a state of consciousness, a state of being, not intellectual thinking, being, where your vibrational state is so powerful and so high that this stuff they throw at us in food and drink and electromagnetic stuff will not affect us. We're above it all. We're no longer able to be manipulated because we're no longer at the vibrational consciousness level at which these sick people operate. But what they have to do, is, because they're in a box, a massive box, a concrete box, they have to put humanity in a smaller box so they're in a position of control. And what's happening now is more and more people are actually cracking the box. And when you do that, they vibrationally cannot make a connection to you anymore. They're like Radio 1 and Radio 2. They pass in the same space, but they don't connect. And so the stepping stone of being aware of how we're being manipulated is one thing. But once we get into that level of consciousness that you're talking about, then we're beyond, we're the untouchables from that point of view, because they can't make a vibrational connection. And if they can't do that, they can't make a physical connection, because the physical is just a holographic expression of the energetic.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And that's why cosmology is starting to come to the forefront now, because basically, you know, in cosmology and quantum mechanics, if you're walking across the room, in the old days, you just walked across the room. Today, you walk across the room, but you go everywhere and every when in the universe and space and time simultaneously. And so what they're really saying is the electron doesn't go around the proton, it goes everywhere. And I wrote about that years ago, and that's what's coming to pass. And therefore, when you get control of that through consciousness and not electromagnetic forces, that electron will go bust, you walk through that box. And they are, I always tell people over here, the government's in the fishbowl, not us.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly the situation there. But they have to try to hold us in a smaller fishbowl.
And ignorance doesn't recognize itself.
The pinhead and infinity are the same thing.
Yeah.
That everything is one. Then the limitations of looking in the mirror and saying, that's me, just fall. That's just something that's just one level of you. It's just one level of you that's experiencing this one tiny frequency range. That's not what you are. You are
right, and you know what? I know that you're the same as I am. And I was born in 1943. You know, I was born in a world war, but at least the oxygen level was higher. The air was cleaner. You know, there was a war over fascism, but the environment was so much better. Today, the environment sucks. And I look at these young kids, these little babies, and in my neighborhood, there's a lot of new arrivals. And I look at these kids, and I say, you know what? I'm going to make this a much better world for this child than it was for me, because that's all I got to do anymore. I've seen it all, done it all in this world, and I'm sure you have too. And I look at those young children, these families, these kids, people moving up in our neighborhood, and young families, and I'm saying, maybe they're not going to get it, but I'm going to get it for them, and eventually their kids will get it. And that just puts fire in me, you know what I mean? It fires up the electrons.
If you can... Take your point of perception while in the physical body to the point of perception you have when you leave the limitations of the physical body. And you can see this in accounts by near-death experiences and stuff, where suddenly the world is a very, very different place from what you perceived it when you were, if you like, in it, for want of a word. If you can do that, then your whole perception of life changes, because what is perceived as successful here when you're in it, what is perceived as what you want to do with your life and the decisions you make are very, very different in your perception of did I make the decision I should have made or not when you're out of the body. When you are in an out-of-body state, your self-interest and the interest of all are the same thing. Whereas when you're in the body and caught in this illusion, you can perceive what is right and what is in your self-interest as being different. And therefore you do things from self-interest instead of doing what's right. And what would change this world overnight is if people just did what they believed to be right rather than what they believed was right for them in the moment. Because when they leave the body, their perception of what was right in that moment will dramatically change. Because at that point, you'll realize it's not about, you know, a bigger car or getting this job or that job. It's about serving the whole. In other words, from the highest perspective, serving yourself, serving the greater good. And if we put the greater good before perceived self-interest, then the world would dramatically change. Because one of the great ways that we're controlled is playing someone's perceived self-interest against someone else's perceived self-interest, and therefore dividing and ruling the population as a result. If we all serve the greater good, then we're all on the same side.
I agree, and I think that's part of what I know for a fact I've been through it, and I can definitely tell in your words you've been through it too. So we've all made our mistakes, but if you admit your mistake and say I'm only human at this point, and I'll not make that mistake again, and fix it, then you start to break out of that shell of self-influence and self-interest and self-introspect.
Yeah, what we call mistakes are opportunities to see beyond the illusion. And,
exactly. I love the way
you're
a great orator.
People had an easy life and had everything done for them. They're the babes in arms when it comes to what's unfolding now, not the people who've had the challenges and had to overcome them.
Yeah, I agree. So anyway, we're running close to the time limit here. If we haven't run over, it won't matter because you're so popular over here. You know you're an icon in the American scene just like you are in the rest of the world. It's a real pleasure having you on this show. And finally getting to actually go one-on-one with you, which we've never done.
That's right.
And this, I've known who you are and about your work for years, and you've been a great inspiration. And I think I might have known you maybe during the American Revolution. You could have been like Patrick Henry, the great orator, because you have a
it's a strange thing because I get some wonderful people contacting me and about my stuff and that, but I live in a little two bedroom flat in Ryde. One of the bedrooms is my little office where I do everything out of, and I just get up in the morning and do what I think is right until I go to bed and communicate things as best I can and increase my understanding, because if anyone thinks they've got it, they're just telling you they haven't got it because there's so much to get. And what happens, and that's all I've ever done, you know. And it's amazing what you can do with apparently very little if you're just determined not to take no for an answer. And you know, there's so many people around the world who have committed themselves to this who are now beginning to see, hey, it's been worth it. It's been worth it. I could see it was worth it. When for so many years you thought, oh, my goodness, why am I bothering, you know?
Yeah, but see, out of that little two-bedroom flat on the Isle of Wight in the town of Ryde where you live, and the disciplines and the energy you put out, you have basically brought yourself into what I call immortality. You're indestructible now. And that's the beauty of it. And that gives you confidence to elevate the whole consciousness of this world to a much higher plane than it is now. And it's not done by some magic fairy dropping by fairy dust. It's done by the likes of a person like you doing what you're doing right now on this network. That's what makes the difference. Because a lot of people are going to hear this. It's going to be repeated many times over. And your energy is going to be an influence to a lot of people. And we have a huge, growing, young audience on the BBS because we're so crazy here. But your words are really, even talking to you, you've raised my energy. You've given me a blast of your energy, and I'm going to have a great day after this interview, let me tell you.
What's great is the number, you mentioned it there, the number of young people who are turning to this.
Yeah.
Because I say to people, if you've been through the education system, and you've had that indoctrination, and you've had the indoctrination through the media, you've had indoctrination through peer pressure, indoctrination often from parents who are passing on their programming to you, not with malevolence, but because they believe that's right. If you've gone through all that, and you're still have awakened to this, then, you know, you deserve a massive pat on the back, because that's some powerful consciousness to actually hold its sense of self, hold its sense of perception through all that bombardment, trying to get it to shut down and become a programmed repeater of the system's version of reality. I mean, it's wonderful that it's just testament to the fact that there is something different going on now. There is some energetic change going on, which is making it easier for people to wake up and hold that perception of the true magnitude of life and the true magnitude of who we are.
Yeah. I have a question for you now. What's your schedule like, the rest of the year and next year? What have you got? Are you doing it one day at a time, or are you planning some outings and public speaking here and there? Where are you going to be?
I've got a new book coming out now, and I know I'm going to go on some journeys in the next 2 or 3 months, journeys within myself to get some more of these onion skins breaking up, so I can get a more expanded view of everything. And that's very important, because if someone's saying exactly the same a year after they said it before, then what they've been doing for the last year, it's important that we keep expanding our minds and keep getting a greater grasp on things. But what I do is I do everything by intuition. Everything, literally everything. And so when something comes along, I'll say yes or I'll say no based on intuition, which on the face of it might not. Well, why do you say yes to that, no to that? Because my intuition said so, no other reason. So that's what I'm doing. And, how this coming year will unfold, I don't know. But it's quite fluid at the moment, to say the least.
Well, I only started doing. I did a lot of lectures, and for 10 years I stopped. I figured I'd made some kind of a mess of things, or something positive would come out of it. So I stopped doing things for 10 years. This year in May, I came out and did the first public speaking I'd done in a long time. I started radio about 3 years ago again, but I didn't come out. Now I'm coming out and I'm doing some big, gathering presentations, like that thing I was telling you about off air in New York, and I was wondering if something really good event comes along, I could ring you up and maybe get you to participate in it. And
sure, no, yeah, absolutely, no problem. I mean, anything that will expand the number of people in awareness that there are other explanations to life than the one they're given, then I'm up for it.
Okay, good. And then do you have a title for your new book that's coming out that you're finishing?
Yeah, it's called The David Icke Guide to the Global Conspiracy, and then in brackets, and How to End It. And it's a hell of a lot of new information in there, but it's also a dot-connecting exercise over 28 chapters and 600 pages. I call the chapters dots, actually. And it's kind of the end of this cycle of my life that book represents, because I want to go out there, if you like, from here on, and seek the key to unlocking the door, rather than just looking only at the door in the cell. I want to find the key to open the door and get the heck out of it. And I think that doesn't lie in this world; it lies in other worlds.
Yeah, you're still a young guy. You're a good-looking young guy, I feel you got another 50 years of work here. I don't know if you're up for it or not, but it looks like it from what this interview was about, that's what it's building up. Because I think once we do cross the threshold, and I think then we're going to be in charge of making the new world happen. You know what I mean? The real new world order, where it's really new, not the old world order under the auspices and the reptilian thing, the new world order. We're going to do the real thing, So it'll be fun to see you out here again. I think you're going to have a blast.
Yeah, that'll be great.
Yeah, that's really good. In closing, give out your website and how to get a hold of you, and so that the listeners can get a hold of you.
It's davidicke.com, I-C-K-E, davidicke.com, and I could be contacted through the website. There's an email address there, and I think they've just put my latest talk up there as well. Which I did in Mount Shasta about 2 or 3 months ago, and it's all going well. And when I look back, nearly 20 years when I started this, it would have been perceived as a miracle for what's happening now to be happening, with the wake up clearly underway, and it's certainly much easier now than it used to be.
Yeah, no, you're doing great. I admire you, and. I live in Laguna Beach in Southern California, and I'd love to have you as my guest sometime if you're down here, and you know, I'll get you information how to get a hold of me and everything.
Okay.
Well, anyway, thank you, David, for being on this show. You've been listening.
Yeah, pleasure. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. You've been listening to Dr. Fred Bell's Health Science and Energy Show with David Icke, a true patriot of the consciousness movement, and we'll be seeing you and talking to you next week. So until then, thank you, everybody, at 1340 AM Tantalk Radio, making us the voice of Tampa Bay, and everybody at bbsradio.com, making us one of the more popular shows. Until next week, thank you very much.